Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, December 4th, and we're in the middle of Chapter 14, which is cardiac output, blood flow, and blood pressure. This is the second lecture. We're probably just going to have two, although scheduled for three, and probably one lecture on respiratory system and one lecture on renal physiology. So I'm still planning on having those chapters on the final exam, as well as diversification system, chapter 20. And somebody mentioned to me that they could not find the study guide in Blackboard. So I went into Blackboard just now, and I couldn't find it in one of the sections. There are four sections in here. I didn't have time to check all four. But I'll make sure that you get a study guide tonight on that. It's going to be very abbreviated, but at least it will tell you what exam figure or exam figures could be on the final. Okay, and next week also I'm going to have an extra credit in lab drawing out. If we have time after lecture today, which I don't think we do, I'll show you what figure that is in the reproductive system. Okay, but if not, I'll get it to you tonight so that you know. Okay, and that will eventually then equalize everybody's extra credit in lab. Okay, so somebody might get 1 point extra credit for that, somebody might get 4 or 5, so that all the labs have the same amount of extra credit. Okay, so nobody gets gypped out of that. Okay, anybody have any questions about the schedule? All right, don't forget on December 13th, that is your final exam. And so that's a Thursday, and there will be a lab before that, and there will be a lab after that. So you might be taking a quiz, but you also have to do that lab. So it's not like a holiday. So, okay. At least you don't have a practicum on that day, like an anatomy. Oof, that's tough. And then I have to submit grades by the 15th. All right, so this is a real important consideration. I have to submit grades by the 15th because Blackboard is going away. And I have to have all of your current and correct scores in Blackboard. So you should, I'm going to get your lab grades in there and just double check your lab grades are correct and the grades I entered for your tests are correct. Because after the 15th, then I can't change your grades. I mean, only if it's a life and death situation. Because if I change somebody's final grade, that's going to trigger an audit. All right, so it's a big thing. It's a big hassle for people over in administration. So anyhow, all right, so let's carry on with chapter 14. We were talking about blood pressure and three hormones that help regulate blood pressure. Okay, and I got to start this slideshow. Ah, here's the slideshow button. Some pointer options, arrow options. All right, so here are the three hormones that we were talking about. Antidiuretic hormone, aldosterone, and atrial natriuretic hormone. And we were talking about antagonism, how important that is. So let's just kind of review what some of the overall effects on blood pressure is with these hormones. Okay, so antidiuretic hormone, what's the effect on blood pressure? Increases blood pressure. And you should know the mechanism by which that happens. Okay, but it's going to either be by increasing blood volume, by resorbing fluids in the kidney, or resorbing salt. And when salt is resorbed from the filtrate in the kidney, water goes along with it. Okay, and so that's how aldosterone works, by increasing blood pressure, by making sure that you don't run out of sodium inside your body. So that sodium is resorbed from a kidney tubule, and that brings water from the filtrate back into your body as well in the kidney. All right, so antidiuretic hormone and aldosterone are synergistic. They both increase blood pressure. So you might be getting pretty anxious and worried because your blood pressure is going higher and higher and higher because that's all the hormones that we have. But here's the third one, atrial natriuretic hormone. And, of course, that natri refers to sodium, right? And we can use sodium to regulate volume in the kidneys and then blood volume after that. And so natri just refers to sodium, and it's a hormone that comes from the heart, in particular the atria. And, of course, it goes into the blood, and let's see what it does once it's in the blood. All right. Oh, but before we do, I just flashed by this slide right here, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. All right. Make sure you commit this to memory. You don't have to actually know all of these pharmaceuticals that I was talking about, but this you want to commit to memory forever. okay, because it's the most important mechanism for long-term regulation of blood pressure. All right, so not minute to minute, not hour to hour, maybe not even day to day, but from week to week, month to month, okay, and a little bit day to day. We're going to look at some other mechanisms a little bit earlier, later. All right, so going on to atrial natriuretic hormone, I call it hormone, your book calls it a peptide. When there's expanded blood volume, when you're retaining a lot of fluids, then you have a lot of venous return. So a lot of blood returns to the heart and fills up the atria, and the atria expand. During what phase of the heart cycle? When do the atria expand? During diastole is the right word, okay? Diastole, which is relaxation. All right, so that stretches the atrium. And there are stretch receptors in the atrium that monitor that, and as a result of that stretch, the atrium releases atrial natriuretic hormone. Right, and that hormone inhibits aldosterone. And what was the effect of aldosterone once again? Increases blood pressure, so atrial natriuretic hormone does what? Helps blunt that effect, so helps reduce blood pressure. Okay, it promotes salt and water excretion. So it's going to excrete sodium in urine and water in urine. So that's going to decrease blood volume, that's going to decrease venous return, and that's going to decrease blood pressure. And also, atrial natriuretic hormone promotes vasodilation, so it relaxes smooth muscle in arteries and veins. And if you have a balloon filled with air, or maybe even water, and you squeeze that balloon to make the volume smaller, what happens to the pressure inside that balloon when you squeeze on it? It goes up, okay? You can do that pretty easily, but the reverse is kind of hard to do. Grab that balloon once again and now stretch it out. Pretend you can do that. What happens to the pressure inside the balloon when you stretch it out? It decreases. Okay, so use that same kind of rationale to understand when blood vessels are dilated, that decreases blood pressure. Okay, and that's what atrial natriuretic peptide does. All right, so atrial natriuretic peptide together with decreased ADH acts in negative feedback to lower blood volume, and when that happens, that lowers blood pressure. So I think this is a pretty good exam figure. I think this is an exam figure. Can anybody corroborate that? Is this an exam figure? Anybody recognize it? Maybe it's not. Okay, but let's go over it anyway. All right, so when you have increased blood volume, okay, you have increased venous return, more blood returning to the heart, that stretches the atrium, and how does the atrium respond? By secreting atrial natriuretic hormone. So that goes up. All right, but there are also signals sent by the vagus nerve to the brain to the posterior pituitary. All right, so this is part of a reflex mechanism. And the posterior pituitary, how is the posterior pituitary controlled? By what part of the brain? The hypothalamus, right? So the hypothalamus gets information from the vagus nerve and then makes a decision to decrease secreting antidiuretic hormone. All right, because the hypothalamus is in control. So that decreases water resorption. And so that atrial natriuretic peptide or stretch of the atrium is acting like a diuretic in that case because it's what? Preventing the secretion of an antidiuretic. If you prevent the secretion of an antidiuretic, that's like giving a diuretic. Okay, you're kind of familiar with that. Okay, the other thing is atrial natriuretic hormone goes to the kidney, and that causes resorption of sodium from the filtrate into the blood. And so you got to remember the structure of a nephron and know where filtrate is, but if something stays in the filtrate, where does it eventually end up? Okay, ends up in urine, and then you lose it from your body, right? And so if the sodium is resorbed, increase the sodium and water excretion. Okay. Hold on. Excretion. We're trying to reduce blood pressure. Okay. So the kidney tubules, right, don't resorb sodium from the filtrate. It stays in the filtrate, and then where does the sodium go? In the urine, and you lose it from your body. And when you lose sodium from your body, that drags water along with it because of osmotic gradients. Right? So atrial natriuretic hormone increases the excretion of sodium, okay, and that reduces blood volume because your urine volume is going up, And so this is the response, decreased blood volume. And what was the initial stimulus? Increased blood volume. What's the relationship between decreased blood volume and increased blood volume? They're opposite, right? So this is a nice negative feedback mechanism, and that's why this minus sign is right here. All right, so let me say something about this sodium, because it was just a little bit confusing. All right, so atrial natriuretic hormone causes the loss of sodium from your body, right? And remember, atrial natriuretic hormone is antagonistic to aldosterone, okay? So that means that aldosterone increases, right, the reabsorption of sodium from the filtrate. So your body retains sodium. Aldosterone helps you retain sodium, and atrial natriuretic hormone helps you lose sodium, and that's a direct effect on blood volume and blood pressure. Okay, when we get into the urinary chapter, I'll review that a little bit. Okay, so let's move on to another topic, some factors affecting blood flow. Okay, and then the effects of blood flow, these factors, how it works with blood pressure. All right, so vascular resistance determines how much blood flows through a tissue. The resistance is what? Just what impedes the flow of blood. The higher the resistance, then blood flow decreases, right, if the pressure stays the same. If there's a vasodilation, when a blood vessel gets larger in diameter, the resistance decreases. And there's an inverse relationship, which I'll show you, and I think you guys are familiar with this already. There's an inverse relationship between resistance and blood flow. So when resistance goes up, what happens to blood flow if they're inversely related to each other? They're opposite, right? So if resistance decreases, flow increases because of that inverse relationship, and you'll see that in just a second. And the opposite is true. If there's vasoconstriction because of that inverse relationship, what happens to resistance? Okay, it increases, okay, which then decreases blood flow. All right, so here is just a little table that you can read, and it's not an exam figure, but it just kind of gives you an overall estimate of blood flow as a percentage of cardiac output, how much blood is pumped by the heart. And here we can see that blood flow through the gastrointestinal tract is about a quarter. And the kidneys is almost 20%. As a matter of fact, you could just remember 20%. And remember, your kidneys are really small. They're about as big as your fist. But they get 20% of the blood that your heart pumps out. So that's pretty amazing, because they have to condition the blood, right? And we'll talk about everything that the kidneys do. Brain gets a pretty big chunk, but not as much as the kidneys. Brain is a lot bigger. You would think the brain is even more active than the kidneys, but that's not true because of all the sodium potassium pumps that the kidney has to use to control these gradients of water and electrolytes. So the kidney is highly metabolic. Skeletal muscles, probably when you're in a wakeful state, skin not very much, doesn't do a whole lot. Okay, and all the other organs, only about 10%. So the reason why I mentioned that was because of the kidneys. Very important. So the kidneys are producing urine all the time. And if they're metabolically challenged or if they stop producing urine, then that kills the kidneys. So they're very sensitive to other kinds of pathologies that you have, like diabetes, for instance, and high blood pressure. All right, so let's talk about some of the physical laws describing blood flow. And I wrote these on the board last time. All right, so I think you should be familiar with it. So we're talking about blood, which is a fluid, and it can move from one area to another based on something. What is that something that a fluid can, or yeah, any kind of fluid, whether it's a liquid or a gas, it's going to go by pressure, from high pressure to low pressure. Just like osmosis or diffusion of a molecule, it'll go from high concentration to low concentration automatically. All right, so the flow rate is directly proportional to the pressure difference between these two points along a tube. And here we have an illustration of the heart. You can see it's got two sides, four chambers, all that stuff, nice diagram. And it pressurizes blood, this left ventricle, put in a little V right there. I just noticed that, little LV. Everybody says LV, not L. Okay. So the left ventricle contracts, and during systole, it reaches a maximum of 120 millimeters of mercury. During diastole, Okay, in the aorta right here, it goes down to 80, and if we take the average of all of that, or the mean, that's 100 millimeters of mercury, because, you know, it goes up and down. If you just take the average, it's 100. And then if we measure the pressure in the right atrium, we are going to find that the pressure is zero with respect to atmospheric pressure. It's actually right at zero, right at atmospheric pressure. So that's the gradient. That's the pressure gradient from the left ventricle to the right atrium that is going to push blood through what? What is blood being pushed through here? This is some anatomy, not labeled on your slide. It is the systemic circulation, right? Systemic circulation. What is the circulation between the right ventricle and the left atrium? That's the pulmonary circulation. All right, so we're just talking about the systemic circulation, probably from now on, unless I say something about the pulmonary. All right, so the pressure difference, okay, is 100 millimeters of mercury because it's zero in the right atrium. That's the force that's pushing blood through these vessels right here. But in order to know the flow, what else do we have to know? The pressure is one thing, but we have to know what the resistance to that flow is. And we just call that resistance. So we have to know something about resistance because what do we know about blood flow? Blood flow, oh, I can do that. Blood flow is equal to the pressure, and on this slide we have delta P divided by resistance. All right, so that's a little equation that you should just memorize. So we can see that blood flow is directly related to pressure. Pressure goes up, what happens to blood flow? It increases as long as resistance stays constant. If pressure stays constant and resistance goes up, what happens to blood flow? Goes down because of that inverse relationship. That's why that's really handy to look at. Okay, so you studied Poiseuille's law in lab, okay, which is basically just this equation right here, which is on the slide. It just says that flow is the difference in pressure divided by the resistance of that blood vessel. And so we now want to know, how do we figure out the resistance within a blood vessel? And you know that it has something to do with the viscosity of the blood. It has something to do with the length of the blood vessel. Okay. So what we have right here, resistance, what is resistance? Somebody should tell me what resistance is. What about the length of a blood vessel? If we increase length, what happens to resistance? Does it go down or go up? Okay, it goes up. So we want to put it here, directly related. Okay. And if the viscosity increases, what happens to blood flow? If it gets syrupy, okay? If blood gets syrupy, then the resistance increases, okay? So we want to put viscosity here, and the funny little Greek symbol is a nu, like that. Okay, so that's viscosity. And then there's something else that's really important, and that is the amount of vasodilation and vasoconstriction, and that we measure by knowing the radius of that blood vessel. Okay, and remember we said when the blood vessel dilates, when the radius gets bigger, what's the relationship to resistance? Resistance goes down. So where do we want to put it? Down here in the numerator. All right, but we would be cheating ourselves to think that it just scales linearly with the radius of a blood vessel. That's not really true, because how does it go when you change the radius? This denominator, right, changes in a huge way because it is, what, r to the fourth power. It's radius times radius times radius times radius. So a small change in radius is a huge change in this denominator right here, which means that it's a huge change in the resistance of in that blood vessel, which means then that there's a big difference in blood flow because there's a huge difference in r. All right, so we could put, you know, maybe I'll just leave that equation right up there, erase it. So we got delta P, and then we got R, but here's R. What's R? L, like this, divided by R to the fourth power. But that looks pretty complicated. What could we do? We could multiply the top and the bottom by R to the fourth power, right? And then, so what do we get? Delta P, R to the fourth power, the length, okay, the viscosity, and then some other factors that make sure that all the units match up, and that's that pi over 8 deal. Okay, so if we look at this, if we increase the radius, what happens to blood pressure? How are they related? They're directly related. So if the radius increases, so does blood flow. Okay, so you can look at that. And that's basically Poiseuille's law, and you work with that. So the diameter of a blood vessel is very important for controlling resistance and blood flow through various tissues. Okay, so here we have a plot of blood pressure versus not time, but different kinds of blood vessels that you have in your body. So if we're going to put a pressure meter in different blood vessels, these are the pressures that we would monitor. Right, and you're kind of familiar with this already from the Wiggers diagram. So here is the left ventricle, and the pressure varies from 0 during what phase? Diastole to 120 millimeters of mercury, which is systole, that's at the contraction. So the pressure changes quite a bit. All right, and then the heart pumps blood into large arteries, and we still feel this pressure pulse in arteries. All right, because of the capacitance of arteries, the pressure doesn't go to 0, which is really good, because what would happen if your blood pressure went to 0? Okay, then in 2 seconds you would become unconscious, right, because you need oxygen to the brain to make ATP. All right, so that's a really good thing. All right, so there is not much of a difference between the left ventricle and large arteries, but now when we get to smaller blood vessels, we see that the pressure begins to drop. All right, let's see if I can look at this equation. The pressure begins to drop. Okay, pressure begins to drop. I don't want to talk about that equation right now. And that's because there's an increase in resistance, because the diameter of these vessels are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So the resistance goes up, blood flow stays the same, but the pressure then decreases. All right, because the blood flow stays the same. All right, and then in capillaries, we see even a little bit more decrease in pressure. And then in venules, a little bit more, but in large veins, there's hardly any decrease in pressure at all. It's almost at 0 already. So if we look at this graph right here, we're going to compare this to, so this is pressure versus blood vessel. We're going to compare this to another graph that looks at blood flow plotted against a number of different vessels. All right, so you're going to have to remember this one. What part of the cardiovascular system has the highest pressure when we look at this graph? It is the ventricles and large arteries. Okay, and which vessels have the lowest pressure? Okay, and you can see it right here. I heard capillaries. Okay. All right, but actually, if we look at this diagram, it is what? Large veins have the lowest pressure. It just seems to some people that you want to say capillary has the lowest pressure because you know that's where exchange takes place. So you know that's an important functional part of the cardiovascular system, but that's not the lowest pressure. If it was the lowest pressure, if it was lower than large veins, would blood ever go back to the heart? No, blood would go back to capillaries, right, and stay there. And that doesn't happen. You know it goes back to the heart because of the delta P term. All right, so make sure you can answer these questions like we just did. So blood flow can be delivered to the brain or to muscles or to the digestive tract. Specifically, you don't have enough blood in your body to go maximally to all the organs of your body. Your blood pressure would just plummet. So your autonomic nervous system has to figure out where blood should go. And it does that. For instance, if you're exercising, it's going to cut off blood supply to the digestive tract and dilate blood. How would it cut off a blood supply to the digestive tract? By vasoconstricting arterioles, and then it's going to vasodilate arterioles in muscles. Okay, so blood goes to the muscles. Can't dilate everything. Okay, so the autonomic nervous system has to figure that out. All right, so here we have a couple plots of blood plotted out against a number of different blood vessels, again, like aorta, arteries, arterioles, capillaries. And this right here, centimeters squared, so you know what a centimeter looks like. And a centimeter squared is what, a cube, right? And that is like a doorway. Okay, that's just a surface area of 1 square centimeter. So this is the surface area. Think of this as like a tabletop that's really, really tiny. Okay, and it's plotted out against all these different vessels right here. And we can see that the aorta has a very small cross-sectional area. When we look at the aorta, we can see it. It looks big, okay, but compared to the cross-sectional area of other vessels, right, it is really small. So if we go to capillaries and cut open every capillary and measure the surface area of this capillary and this one here, and then all the other billion capillaries that are in your body, lay them flat down on a table, we can see that the surface area is a lot bigger. Okay, so the diameter, if we were to look at the diameter of the aorta compared to capillaries, we see that if we add all the capillaries together, it's 5,000 times more. It's a 5,000 times bigger doorway. Same blood flow through those two different spaces, something that's really narrow, something that's really dilated. Okay, and we see that that the cross-sectional area of a capillary is thousands of times more than the aorta. All right, but let's look at this plot on the bottom. Again, it's a variable plotted against these different blood vessels, and this is centimeters per second. What the heck is centimeters per second? You're really familiar with this because you have a gauge in your car that tells you this. Okay, but it's not in centimeters per second, it's in miles per hour, because centimeter is a distance and second, of course, is a time, right? Seconds and hours are time, mile is a distance. So this is just the velocity. Centimeters per second is how fast blood is moving through each of these particular blood vessels. And what blood vessel has the highest velocity? It is what? The aorta right here. Okay. And that's because of the cross-sectional area is relatively small. Now, where do you think the velocity should be the slowest in your cardiovascular system? Because there's something special going on there in capillaries. Now, the velocity of blood shouldn't just whip through a capillary. It should get into a capillary, stay there a little bit of time so exchange can take place. And indeed, that's what we see right here. Right? The lowest velocity or the speed is in capillaries because it has the largest cross-sectional area. And then as the cross-sectional area decreases, as blood flows into veins, then the speed increases, returning blood back to the heart. And that's all determined by this cross-sectional area. All right, so what blood vessels have the slowest velocity? You can see it right here. Why? Because of the cross-sectional area. And then why is that important? Yeah, because if blood doesn't stay in a capillary, then you limit exchange. And we don't want to do that. All right, blood pressure. Blood pressure. We can use this equation a little bit. Okay, I talked about this in just a second ago. Arterioles play an important role in distributing blood. Okay, and they also helps control blood pressure. Okay, and that's done mostly by vasoconstriction or vasodilation. So if we need more blood going to muscles, what do you do to arterioles that go to muscles? Vasodilate. Okay, but you should also vasoconstrict some other arterioles to maintain blood pressure. All right, so it's controlled by the aperture or the diameter of arterioles. Capillary blood pressure is decreased because they are downstream of high resistance. All right, let's look at this little glass tube. Well, let's say it's plastic because we can squish it down and open up this little constriction right here. All right, so we keep this tube right here just at this level. So when this fluid starts to drain out of this tube, we fill it back up to this level. And what that does is that it maintains the pressure at a constant, just a constant force, right? Because if this fluid starts to go down, then the pressure is going to go down. But if we keep it just right at this level, then the pressure is going to be the same, and that's all I want to think about. Let's just keep this pump right here the same, same pressure. And now let's take this little constriction away. And we have these three pipes right here. If we take this constriction away, okay, that's going to vasodilate, that's going to decrease the resistance, that's going to increase blood flow. So we're increasing blood flow. So the pressure here is going to decrease, but what's going to happen to the pressure here? It's going to increase. So there'll be greater blood flow to this particular organ and a little bit less to these right here. And remember, we're keeping pressure constant. But now, if we put a constriction right here, that's going to decrease pressure in this tube and do what to pressure over here? Increase. Okay, and this is what your body does to control blood flow to various organs. And this is, right here just represents an arterial bringing blood to a particular tissue, like muscle, brain, heart, things like that. Okay. Capillary blood pressure is also low because of the large cross-sectional area. Yeah, I'm not so interested in this diagram here. The previous one is much more important. Okay, why is the velocity of blood slowest in capillaries? That you should appreciate. There's some nice physics behind that. Okay, here is a pretty important slide, one of the most important in the cardiovascular system, and it's completely non-intuitive. Okay, it's completely impossible to just understand, but I'll show you how to do it. All right, blood pressure is controlled mainly by heart rate and stroke volume. What's heart rate? Beats per minute, just how fast the heart is beating. And what's stroke volume? The amount of blood that is pumped out of the heart every time it beats. And also peripheral resistance. Peripheral resistance is this term right here. Okay, and it's mostly controlled by what? The radius of a blood vessel. Right? So it's mostly controlled. Peripheral resistance is controlled by radius of arterioles. So if you increase any of these, you increase blood pressure. So how can we figure that out? Okay, what did we say blood flow was? Pressure divided by resistance. That's just a basic kind of term. Okay, and then we also know something about heart rate and stroke volume. What is that equal to? Cardiac output. Cardiac output is equal to heart rate times stroke volume. And what are the units right here? Beats. Yeah, beats per minute. And what's this? Like mLs per beat. So these beats cancel. This is a volume per time. Okay, so this is, I guess I should write that down. A volume per time. So a volume of blood moving through an area for a certain period of time is the flow. So cardiac output really is flow. It's blood flow. How much blood is flowing out of the heart because it's beating. So this is blood flow. What else do you know about blood flow? Blood flow is pressure divided by resistance. So we can get rid of this term here, and we can get rid of blood flow. We can say delta P, since they're equal to each other, delta P over R is equal to what? Heart rate times stroke volume. And now maybe you can see why peripheral resistance is directly related to pressure, because on both sides of this equation, we can multiply by R, like this, and R ends up over here, and what happens to this R? It cancels out, so you got delta P is equal to heart rate times stroke volume times resistance. And so what's the relationship of heart rate, stroke volume, and resistance to pressure? Can I erase these R's right here, because they go away anyway? Well, they turn into one, and if you multiply one by something, what do you get? The same something back, right? Okay. So what's the relationship between blood pressure, this is the delta P, or blood pressure, what's the relationship with blood pressure to heart rate? If we increase heart rate, what happens to pressure? It increases because it's directly related. If we increase stroke volume, or the contractility of the heart, what happens to blood pressure? Because it's directly related. And if we increase resistance, this is a hard one to see, but maybe you saw how it kind of developed a little bit. If we increase resistance, what happens to blood pressure? It increases as well, because they're all directly related to each other. All right, so some people might want to remember this equation right here. I like to, because it's just this sentence, right? But it's in a nice mathematical form. It's easier to appreciate, I think, because you see the relationship, the direct relationship between resistance, stroke volume, and heart rate. So an increase in any of those will result in an increase in blood pressure. And we're familiar with the sympathoadrenal activity. When epinephrine and norepinephrine is released by the adrenal medulla, that raises blood pressure because, why? It causes vasoconstriction, increasing resistance of blood vessels. It increases heart rate and increases stroke volume. So all of these things increase when the adrenal medulla is stimulated. So what happens to blood pressure? It increases probably in a really big way. Okay. And that's good, because when blood pressure increases, all right, that will keep blood flow to all your tissues. Like, for instance, in the fight and flight mechanism, Kidneys play a role in regulating blood pressure because they regulate blood volume and thus stroke volume. Why is that? There's a way. What could you invoke to explain that as you increase blood volume, stroke volume increases? It's a law. That's a hint. It's a law. It's the Frank Starling law, right? As you stretch the ventricle, it gets stronger because now you have better overlap of actin and myosin. So as blood volume increases, more blood goes back to the heart. Things stretch out. The ventricle gets stronger. Contractility goes up. That means the stroke volume goes up, okay? Because contractility is increased. Okay. Who can tell me what the most important long-term mechanism for controlling blood pressure is? Yes, it's the renin, angiotensin, aldosterone mechanism. And as a matter of fact, you could even call it the dreaded renin, angiotensin, aldosterone mechanism if you want. It's not too bad to understand if you draw it out a couple times. That's the most important for long-term regulation of blood pressure. The baroreceptor reflex is the most important mechanism for controlling blood pressure in the short term, like from minute to minute, second to second. All right, so it works with the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, but this is more of a neuronal reflex. All right, so remember, nervous system is fast, but the duration is slow. Endocrine system is what? Slow to develop, but it is very persistent. That's why these mechanisms are for two different periods of time. So, for instance, right now, you're sitting down, and you're going to be listening to a lecture, and you're becoming really comfortable, and you're really understanding the lecture, and your homework is all done, so you're very relaxed, your blood pressure is starting to decrease, and then all of a sudden, lecture is over, and you got to get up to your next class, maybe it's a quiz or something. You stand up, okay, your blood pressure drops just because you change body position, and if it continues to drop, you might even pass out. So there are pressure receptors, okay, which we call baroreceptors. Remember, a barometer is something that can measure pressure. So there are baroreceptors which can monitor stretch in the aortic arch. You know where that is, in carotid sinus. You should know where that is, too, though your anatomy book doesn't ever really say. But where is the carotid sinus at? You have a common carotid. Yep, you got a common carotid. Gets to about right here, and then it bifurcates to an internal and an external. Internal goes to the brain. External goes to outside the cranium. That comes from the common carotid artery. Right at that junction, there's a little swelling, and that's where these stretch receptors are. That's the carotid sinus right here. Okay? So an increase in blood pressure causes these regions to stretch, and they got stretch receptors or baroreceptors right there, and that increases the frequency of action potentials going to the cardioregulatory and vasomotor center in the medulla. Okay, and your book calls it the vasomotor center and the cardiac control center. That's okay. You could call it that if you want. And the medulla. All right, so these baroreceptors are most sensitive to sudden changes in blood pressure, like when you're going from sitting to standing up or lying down to standing up. Okay, and as a matter of fact, somebody's blood pressure might be so low that you might even get a little dizzy when you do that. Right? As long as you pass out, as long as you don't pass out, that's fine. Okay. The lower your blood pressure is, the more protected your heart and blood vessels are. But if it's so low that you can't maintain consciousness, then that's not good. Then you should give me your driver's license, right? Okay. Okay, so let's look at the baroreceptor reflex. You actually looked at this in the first lab. Okay, so here's the carotid sinus right here. Here's the common, right? Here's internal and external, little subclavian going out over there. Well, the rest of that stuff you know. So there are stretch receptors in the carotid sinus, stretch receptors in the arch of the aorta. So these are receptors, right? So they pick up information from the blood and send it in to the central nervous system, right? And what kind of fibers are these? It says sensory, but you should probably call these afferent, right? Afferent neurons bringing information in to the medulla, and in particular the vasomotor center and the cardiac control center. And so there's a set point for blood pressure right here, and it compares the set point to what the blood pressure is, and then the vasomotor center, cardioregulatory center make a decision on what to do. And it sends that decision out through what? An efferent pathway, then so that it can complete a nice negative feedback loop, right? So these efferents right here are going to cause an effector to change in such a way to counteract what the initial stimulus was. So that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so let's just say that the pressure is decreasing. The vasomotor center knows that because it's getting information from the baroreceptors in these two locations. It notices blood pressure is decreasing. What should be the decision of the cardiac or the cardioregulatory center? If your blood pressure is decreasing, what should the cardioregulatory center say? How about increased heart rate? What will happen to blood pressure? It will increase. How about let's stimulate the heart, the ventricles to contract stronger, increase stroke volume. What happens to pressure? Goes up. And the vasomotor center is going to say what to blood vessels? Better start to constrict a little bit to maintain blood pressure, and then you don't lose consciousness and you can be on your way to that quiz. Okay. So that's what happens when blood pressure decreases, and the opposite, of course, happens when blood pressure increases, but not in the long term. It's what? Only sudden changes. So the baroreceptor reflex is hugely important, but only for sudden changes in blood pressure. Okay, and don't forget that the parasympathetic nervous system only goes to the atrium, nodal tissues in the atrium, and so do sympathetic fibers. That increases heart rate. All right, so here we have the parasympathetic and sympathetic nerves controlling heart rate, just this one term in this equation. But where else does the sympathetic go? It goes to the ventricles as well. And that's going to cause increased contractility of the ventricles. I showed you a plot of that earlier. And so that's going to increase stroke volume. Okay, so both of these terms go up. That helps maintain blood pressure. Oh, sorry, I should do this. Sorry. I didn't realize I was cheating half of the room out of a slide. Sorry. Hopefully your neck won't be crooked tomorrow. Okay, so this is the baroreceptor reflex. You see the receptors and the different parts. And so you got to know the difference between parasympathetic and sympathetic. So the parasympathetic cannot control which parameter here for blood pressure. Stroke volume. Parasympathetic nervous system has no effect on stroke volume, only heart rate. That's kind of weird. Okay, so here's the baroreceptor reflex. This probably is an exam figure. So going from a lying down position, okay, to a standing position, you're changing, so all of a sudden you start to elevate some part of your body, and that causes, so blood starts to pool in your extremities, that causes decreased venous return. Okay, and so if there's less venous return, what happens to end diastolic volume? It goes down, and because of the Frank-Starling law, when end diastolic volume goes down, the heart doesn't stretch quite so much, so the heart gets what? Weaker, just as a result. So stroke volume goes down. If stroke volume goes down, okay, if stroke volume goes down here, okay, what's the effect on cardiac output? Okay, it's directly related, so it goes down as well. Okay, so I like all those equations right there. So decreased cardiac output, and we know cardiac output is what? Just this term. It's just this term. This is cardiac output. So if these go down, what happens to blood pressure? Oh, did I get it right? Okay, baroreceptor. Oh, yeah, decreased blood pressure. Whew, good. Okay, that's what the equation says. So decreased blood pressure is the stimulus. Hi. If they're in your study guide, yeah. Yeah. You know, I'll probably give you a couple of these things, but I would like you to understand the flow of how this happens. That's kind of a pun. Sorry, I didn't mean to say flow. But understand kind of, yeah, because it's a flow diagram, typical flow diagram. All right, so when cardiac output decreases, blood pressure decreases. All right, baroreceptors sense that. Right, and it sends information via sensory neurons. This is just your basic response loop that you learned the first week. Okay, and it sends information to the cardioregulatory center, vasomotor center located in the medulla, and then it compares that to the set point and says, blood pressure is below normal because normal is the set point, makes a decision on what to do, and it says, if your blood pressure is low, let's increase sympathetic activity and decrease parasympathetic activity. All right, so when we increase sympathetic activity, what happens to heart rate? increases, and we see what the effect is on blood pressure. Okay, increases cardiac output, right, because this term is just cardiac output right here. If that goes up, so does blood pressure. That's what the sympathetic nervous system does. All right, but it also goes to arterioles and causes vasoconstriction. What happens to resistance when we constrict the diameter? Remember, it's radius to the fourth power up in the numerator. So when this increases, again, what happens? Blood pressure increases. So both of these effects increase blood pressure. And what was the initial stimulus? Decreased blood pressure. So what kind of feedback mechanism? It is on this slide. It's what kind of feedback mechanism? Negative feedback mechanism. Okay. So that's the most important. So baroreceptor reflex is the most important mechanism for what kind of regulation? Short-term regulation of blood pressure. Yeah. Okay. So you got to know how that is all integrated together. So that's a really important slide. So yeah, I hope it is an exam figure. Otherwise, I kind of feel like I'm cheating you out of something. Okay. All right. So that's it for 14. And so jot some of these equations down. Maybe try to do some algebra and figure out this equation right here. Then you don't have to memorize it, but at least memorize this equation to understand how blood pressure changes with heart rate, stroke volume, and resistance. Okay. And if you just look at that equation, it's incomprehensible to me unless I develop it by knowing some of the previous equations. Yeah. Yeah, beats per minute. Heart rate is beats per minute. Stroke volume is volume per beat. And then you get a cardiac output. Volume per time. Yeah. Okay, so you can handle that stuff. But without knowing that equation, yeah, it will be really hard to understand what's going on. Okay, so we can put that away. And what do we have to do next? Respiratory system. Oh, I didn't bring any of my props for respiratory system. Next time. Okay, got time to go get them? Not necessarily. Okay, so respiratory system. We're going to look at some respiratory structures. This is kind of a review from anatomy, physical aspects of ventilation, mechanics of breathing. Maybe talk about some disorders, factors, control of ventilation, hemoglobin. Ah, this is important. Hemoglobin and carbon dioxide transport. All right, so right up over here, the very bottom one is carbon dioxide transport, and the item above that is hemoglobin, but we could say something transport related to hemoglobin. What's related to hemoglobin? It's transport, but what kind of transport? Not carbon dioxide, but oxygen. Okay, so these two compounds, oxygen and carbon dioxide, are carried by the blood via two different kinds of mechanisms. And we'll take a look at that. Visible. Okay. So respiration, we studied respiration. We talked about aerobic respiration, anaerobic respiration. Okay. So sometimes respiration refers to metabolism inside a cell and whether oxygen is being utilized. We call that cellular respiration. Okay. But sometimes respiration is used for just ventilating, just for moving gas in and out of your lungs. That's also respiration, how you're breathing. And then respiration could also be considered how these gases that are in the lungs exchange with the blood, right? So all of these things are considered respiration, and you just have to know from the context of how that word is being used what kind of respiration they're talking about, whether it's mechanical or chemical, biochemical, oxygen utilization, or whatever. Okay. And internal respiration, I've never heard anybody say anything about internal respiration, but that is what? Referring to metabolism. Okay, I would really call that what? Cellular respiration. Internal respiration is the same thing as cellular respiration. Okay, and gas exchange, both CO2 and oxygen, is due to diffusion. All right, so where should oxygen go? Should you be excreting oxygen, or should you be importing oxygen into your body? Yeah, oxygen should go in your body to make those mitochondria really nice and happy. And how does that oxygen get inside your body? Is the concentration of oxygen in your body low or high compared to the air? It's got to be low, otherwise oxygen would never go in because it's just passive. It's kind of counterintuitive because you think, well, I need oxygen. Well, the concentration should be high. but it has to be lower than the air, otherwise oxygen would never go in. And the reverse is true for carbon dioxide. Okay, you're going to get rid of carbon dioxide, so where's carbon dioxide at a low concentration? Outside in the air so that it leaves your body. Carbon dioxide is high, relatively high inside your body, and it's almost zero in the atmosphere that we have here. Okay, so there's a big concentration gradient for carbon dioxide. So what does that mean about the movement of carbon dioxide out of your body? If there's a big concentration gradient, it's relatively rapid, it's a very efficient process, right? Just like if there's a big pressure difference on two ends of a tube, then you have a lot of flow, a lot of motion. Okay, so some respiratory structures, you know, the lungs, there's the hilum of the lung, and this is where arteries and veins enter and leave the lung, as well as some of these air passageways. So you've got the trachea, primary bronchus, and then after the first bifurcation, you got a secondary bronchus right here, right, and then tertiary, smaller and smaller and smaller. And all of these structures have cartilage around them so that they stay open all the time. And that's important. Does anybody know why that's important? Okay. Because sometimes when you're breathing rapidly, there's two kinds of breathing that we'll talk about, but when you're breathing rapidly, you have to pressurize your chest to get air out. And if you pressurize your chest, and this was just a smooth muscle right here, then it would collapse. And if that tube were to collapse, then air would be trapped in the lungs. So they're held open all the time, irrespective of what the pressure is inside your pleural cavity or your lungs. Right here. So these are what we call the conducting zones because they stay open all the time. What is one really bad thing about them being open all the time? Stuff can fall in there, okay? Like a little cracker can fall in there or some nachos or something, right? And then air can't go through and then no oxygen gets in the blood and then you just have limited consciousness and maybe limited life as a result of that. And I'm sure there's a lot of people trained in how to clear this airway right here. And oh, there's something fun about that. Because there's an epiglottis that covers that trap, that's a trapdoor that covers the opening into the trachea, opening into the larynx, and that makes food go into the esophagus instead of this trachea right here. But it gets lazy a certain day of the week. Anybody know what day of the week that epiglottis doesn't like to work? And when it doesn't work, then people choke. So most people choke on Friday. Okay, if you said Monday, that's pretty good because I don't want to be at work on Monday. But there's also a certain time on Friday when people choke. And it is right around happy hour. Okay? So it's related to adult beverage, and it's related to, and see, if you were swallowing just as you laughed right there, okay, and you were chewing on a little cracker or something, where would that cracker go? Right into the trachea, okay? Especially if you're inebriated a little bit. Okay? And I'm sure nobody is here. Okay? Okay, so happy hour on Fridays. So if you're CPR certified, when you're in a public place and there's alcohol, just kind of pay attention because I'm sure somebody in here has saved somebody's life by doing a Heimlich maneuver. And it's no longer called that. It's called a thoracic thrust, I think, or abdominal thrust, because Mr. Heimlich or Mrs. Heimlich or both of them got upset when they were using their name because they weren't getting any money compensation for it. Okay, I'm serious. Okay, well at least that's a story I heard, and I believe it. Okay, so then these airways bifurcate some more, and they get to microscopic structures, and these are what we call bronchioles. Bronchioles do not contain cartilage. They can constrict and they can dilate. When they dilate, what happens to airflow through them? Just like a blood vessel. When they dilate, more air can go through. When they constrict, then air can't flow through there. And it's what? To radius to the fourth power. Okay, so bronchial or vasoconstriction or dilation really impedes or enhances the flow of air into the lungs. Okay, we have some respiratory bronchioles, which are really small, no cartilage on them at all, and sometimes they might have an alveolus on them. This is the structural and functional unit of exchange, okay, between the air that's in your lungs and your blood. So some exchange can take place in respiratory bronchioles, but most of the exchange takes place in these alveolar sacs. Because there's no bronchiole there, it's just 100% alveoli. They're just packed with alveoli. And your anatomy book actually shows better alveoli than this physiology book right here. Okay, well, you got a couple of different zones, the conducting zone and the respiratory zone and an alveolus. And if we were to take a cross-section of an alveolus, this is what it would look like. Okay, and here is a capillary, and I see there's a lining. What kind of tissue lines a cavity? An epithelium, but since this is lining the inside of a cavity, it is called an endothelium. And remember, so this is a capillary. What's it specialized for? Exchange, right? It's specialized for exchange. So what kind of endothelium should it be? Should it be a thick endothelium or thin? Thin, and as you know how to classify epithelium, what kind of epithelium is the thinnest that you know? Simple squamous epithelium, and indeed you can see that's what it is right here. Simple squamous epithelium. All right, and also notice what kind of epithelium makes the wall of the alveolus. A nice simple squamous epithelium, again, specialized for exchange. There's a little bit of an interstitial space right here that impedes diffusion, but it's very, very small. Okay, and then there's a layer of junk inside that lines the alveolus. And I got to talk about it today, but I didn't bring an example to talk about it, so I'll do that next time. So here you have air. The kinds of cells, you have macrophages running around in this alveolus because they're shapeshifters, they're crawling around. Do you know the name of that process where a macrophage can be a shapeshifter and crawl between cells and around cells? It's called diapedesis. It just kind of extrudes some cytoplasm in a direction that it wants to go in. Okay, and a macrophage began in the blood as a monocyte, and then it moved out, and then it changes its name. Okay, and it becomes a macrophage. It's part of your immune system. It develops an immune response. So that's another kind of cell. The simple squamous epithelium of the alveolus right here is what we call a type 1 alveolar cell. It just makes the wall of the alveolus, and it's a special wall because it's thin. There's another cell that makes the wall of the alveolus. That's a type 2. And a type 2, it secretes a certain compound onto the surface of the alveolus right here. Okay, and I'll describe it a little bit, but I want to do a demonstration next time. Okay, and I want you to think about water, because there's water, there's some water vapor lining this alveolus right here. And what is your conception of water in terms of stickiness? Is it slippery or sticky? Okay, and I want you guys to say it is sticky. And if there's a puddle of water on the floor, of course you can slip on it, but because water molecules are attracted to each other by what kind of bonds? Hydrogen bonds, right? There's hundreds or thousands of hydrogen bonds. Water molecules like to stick together. As a matter of fact, water is so sticky, some animals can even walk right on the surface of water. Like what? Water spiders, mosquitoes, right? They're not strong enough to break those bonds. They're not heavy enough to break those bonds. All right, so water likes to stick together. Water is very sticky. And maybe you could do this at home. Take a saucer that you hold a cup with, right? And then put another saucer, another little plate on top of it, and then just pick up the top plate, and guess what happens? They separate, okay? But now put some water in the bottom saucer, put the top one on there, and then just pick up the top one. Guess what happens to the bottom one? It's stuck to the top one, right? So water is sticky because of a principle that we call surface tension, and that's all due to those hydrogen bonds. So if this alveolus didn't have surfactant, this wall would touch this wall over here, and there's water in there. Guess what would happen? This alveolus couldn't expand. You couldn't develop enough force to rip open an alveolus, and when you can't do that, you won't have any exchange, and then you just have a couple of seconds of consciousness. So the chemical that defeats that is called surfactant. Okay, it's a surface active chemical, and it's basically just a soap. Now, if you put water and soap on your hand, is that sticky or slippery? That's super slippery, right? So surfactant is like a detergent or a soap, and it defeats surface tension so that this alveolus can inflate, and we're on our way. If we were to take every alveolus out from a normal person's lung and peel it like an orange or an apple, and then take all the walls and put it flat on a table, and then take the next one and flatten it out on a table, and take all 300 million alveoli, okay, 300 million are in a typical lung. And how big would that tabletop have to be? If you took every single one, flattened them out, would be between 60 and 80 square meters. 80 square meters is about half of a tennis court. Okay, so did I tell you how to think of a tabletop, a surface area? I didn't. Okay, well, this is kind of fun. Here, too bad, I thought I did. Well, okay, so here we have a ruler, and it's a meter. So this is a meter long, right, a distance. And we could look at the surface area of this doorway right here. How could we measure surface area of this doorway? Okay, we're going to measure the length. We're going to measure the length of the width of the door. Look at that. That's cool. It's exactly 1 meter wide. That's going to be easy, right, because we just need to. And then we multiply the height times the width. All right, so we measured the width at 1. What about the height of this door? Let's measure that. Some of you will be able to. I'll do it over here. Okay, so the height of the door, all right, we're just going to put the meter stick just like that. And what do we got? Exactly 2 meters. All right, so what's the surface area of that doorway? It's 1 times 2, or 2 square meters. And what's in your lungs? 80. All right, so it's 40 times the size of that door. So when we think of a surface area, okay, it's there for exchange. So I want you to think of surface area as what kind of object? A doorway. Think of surface area as a doorway. And as the doorway gets bigger, what can you tell me about exchange? How many people can we get through that door at one time? Two or three? Now just think of a garage door that you can drive your car through. How many people can we get through a garage door at one time? A lot. Maybe 50. Right, so as the doorway gets bigger, the exchange rate gets higher, right? Or as the surface area gets bigger, then exchange is increased, and that's why there's just a huge surface area in the lung based on this nice spherical shape of an alveolus. Okay. Polyhedral in shape, okay, cluster of ends. Okay, that's not so important. Conducting zone, we know this is the conducting zone because these tubes never collapse. Exchange does not take place right here. Oh, you know some interesting things about the trachea. Probably you've done a microscopic analysis of trachea and you see that cartilage. Maybe you have a picture in your mind what cartilage looks like. But the trachea is also lined with something. What lines something again? An epithelium. And remember what kind of epithelium that was? It was a really nifty one. It was a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. All right, so what's the function of cilia, if you're going to tell me in one word? Yeah, motility, right? So they're beating and sweeping all the time. And which way do you think there's also goblet cells in here that secrete mucus, right? So there's mucus, and mucus traps dirt particles as it's moving through, and bacteria and fungi. And the cilia are beating. Which way do you think they're beating? Up or down? Yeah, because the lungs are a closed container, and if you fill it up with mucus and bacteria, then of course you're filled up with mucus and bacteria. That's not good. So it sweeps all that stuff up, okay, into your pharynx. Then remember, your pharynx is your throat, right? It goes past the larynx up into your pharynx right here. And then when that mucus-laden junk is in your pharynx, what do you do? Yeah, you just swallow it down. Get rid of it out of your lungs. Okay, unless you're one of these athletes, then what do you do? Spit it out, especially baseball players. Okay, so this conducting zone does air condition the air, warms, humidifies the air, because your lung tissue is very, very delicate. We don't want to turn it into potato chips, right? So it humidifies the air, and if the air is cold, it warms it up because you don't want to freeze your lungs, or if the air is really, really hot, it helps cool the air down. So that's an important function. Okay. The thoracic cavity. You should know where the thoracic cavity between your shoulders and a muscle, which is called the diaphragm. So it's a nice defined volume inside your body. Okay, it's dome-shaped, and it's just a sheet of muscle. When it's relaxed, it's dome-shaped. When it contracts, it goes flat from the ends. All right, so it depresses. It goes flat, and then it relaxes. It goes back up into your thoracic cavity. Okay, of course your thoracic cavity contains these things. Below the diaphragm, of course, you know all of that stuff. Okay, pretty nice diagram of the thoracic cavity. And there is a serous membrane around the thoracic cavity. And as a matter of fact, the pleural cavity is a subcavity of the thoracic cavity. Maybe that rings a bell. So here is the pleural cavity that contains the lungs. And there are two pleural cavities that are inside the thoracic cavity. And then here's the pericardial cavity, right, which is inside the thoracic cavity once again. And then if we add the pericardial cavity with a cavity above it, then that becomes another cavity that separates the pleural cavity from superior to inferior. And you should really know the name of that cavity, though. It's not really part of the lecture. What's a major cavity in your thoracic cavity? It's right on midline. Okay, because it contains your heart and great blood vessels coming off the base of the heart. So it's really important because those great blood vessels and heart. It's called the mediastinum. Okay, mediastinum. That's used a lot in hospitals. So the mediastinum is right in, is this cavity right here. Okay, so but let's consider just the pleural cavity that contains the lungs. There's a serous membrane around it because, and remember there are two kinds of membranes in your body. There's mucous membranes and serous membranes. Where do you find a mucous membrane? It lines a cavity. What kind of cavity? A cavity that's open to the outside world, right? So your oral cavity is a mucous membrane. And inside the trachea, there's a mucous membrane, right? And you know there's goblet cells in the trachea. So that means that that's kind of a dead giveaway that it's a mucous membrane. Not all mucous membranes have to secrete mucus, but that example, it did. And of course, the trachea is open to the outside world as well. But outside the alveoli, but inside the lung, that the pleural cavity, that's not open to the outside world. Okay, in those interstitial spaces and the blood vessels, that's really inside your body. So there's a serous membrane around the lungs, and which is a second kind of membrane besides a mucus. And mucus membrane is pretty simple, but what can you tell me about a serous membrane? It's relatively complicated. What are the parts? How many parts does it have? It's got three parts, okay? So there is a lining that's right on the visceral organ, okay? Could be a heart, could be lung, could be other visceral organs like stomach or whatever. The part of it is on the visceral organ, and we call that the visceral serous membrane, but since this is a pleural membrane, we call that the visceral pleura for short, okay? And then there's a space, the pleural space, filled with a serous fluid, okay, which is in all serous compartments. And then there's a membrane that lines, right, the thoracic wall. And this one right here is separate from the visceral pleura, so we call that the parietal. So you have a parietal division, which is superficial. You got the visceral division, which is right on the organ, and then you have the pleural space. Okay. So that's something about the membranes, and that pleural space is filled with fluid. Oh, good. Okay. And when you breathe, what happens to your thoracic volume, your thorax? Does it change? You probably don't know how it changes just yet. We haven't talked about it, but it does change, right? When you inhale, you expand your chest, your thoracic volume, okay, and then when you exhale, it contracts. Well, okay, how is it that the lungs expand when the muscles right here, when your rib cage expands? Why is it when the rib cage expands, your lungs expand? One of the reasons why is because of this serous fluid. What kind of fluid would you like to have in there? A sticky fluid or a slippery fluid? Slippery for an alveolus because we want it to inflate, but here we don't want these membranes to separate. Okay, we don't want them to separate. So we want a watery solution in that serous fluid so that when we expand the thorax wall, it's actually grabbing on to the wall of the lungs and helps expand it. All right, so different kinds of properties in these fluids depending on what your body needs. Right, so this is a watery fluid in the serous compartment right here that has a lot of surface tension, which attaches, because of that surface tension, attaches the lungs to the wall of the thorax. So when you expand the thorax, so do the lungs. That's some of the reason. Okay, aspects of ventilation. That's it. Okay, if anybody sees me during office hours on Thursday, remind me to bring some experiments to class. Okay, and I'll know what you're talking about. Yeah. Not 18. Not 18. And abbreviated number 20. So on the last exam, 13, 14, 16, 17, and a little bit of 20.